We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk show. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The world produces more than enough food to provide a healthy diet for everyone. Yet, almost a billion people suffer from food shortages and malnutrition. So here's the question. If there is enough food to go around, why are there so many hungry people? This morning, in this hour of Focus, we'll try to get a better understanding of the geography and some of the causes of world hunger. And we have here two guests. Both of them are on the faculty here at the University of Illinois. Tom Bassett, who is professor of geography, and Alex Winter Nelson, he's professor of agricultural and consumer economics. And they are the co-authors of a book that is titled The Atlas of World Hunger. It is published by the University of Chicago Press, and it is their attempt to maybe take a slightly different approach to trying to measure world hunger, looking at a number of different things and trying to answer that question, well, what are some of the causes? What things really correlate with hunger or lack of hunger? And certainly over time, a lot of different people have made arguments about what are the causes of hunger. And they look in this book at a number of factors and say that perhaps some of those things that people have pointed to in the past and said, yes, hunger is about this. Population, for example, overpopulation. They say, well, I'm not quite so sure that that's really a major problem. But there are other things that they point to, and those are very important when we get around to the question, well, if you're really trying to do something about world hunger, what are some of the best ways to approach that? So as we talk, questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, so that means if it would be a long-distance call, you can use that number. That's 800-222-9455. And also we have the email, so if you'd like to send an email, you can do that, will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, thank you both very much for being here.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
I'm sure we can talk about how it is that people in the past have approached the subject of measuring hunger. But it seems that this project and the index that you worked on developing, it seemed to be driven by this feeling that the explanations that had been offered really didn't do a very good job of answering the question, why is there hunger?
Exactly, David. Yes. A common measure, for example, is the amount of food available to a population in a country. And if you sort of, that is the amount of food produced in a country plus imports minus exports or industrial uses. And then if you divide that by the calories of the value of that food by the population, you can get a number which will tell you whether or not there's enough calories per person in that country. And so if you actually map that, you find that many countries in the world seem to have plenty of calories available for their populations. Countries like Brazil, for example, has surplus. India is the same. But in fact, we know that there are millions of people in both of those countries that suffer from hunger. So we know that that's not the best measure of hunger in today's world.
And that's something that maybe is a little bit surprising. There are many different maps here that attempt to show, maps of the world showing different sorts of things. And if you just look at that it certainly seems that from that viewpoint, there is a lot of food, available food, to provide people in a lot of countries in the aggregate with at least 100% or more of what's the daily amount of calories that's recommended for people. So if all you did was look at that, the picture would be very different from if you look, for example, within countries. Various places within countries, the picture is very different.
So was one of the motivations, in fact, for writing this book, was that we thought that current indicators of hunger were inaccurate, that they weren't that helpful in really pointing to where the problem resides and therefore where to attack it, right? So what is the problem with that particular measure, right? Mm-hmm. Well, it says a lot about production, but says nothing really about distribution of food within a country. So it seems that what we need in a indicator of hunger is not only a measure of food availability, but also food distribution. Mm-hmm. And then that takes us, of course, to issues of income distribution, employment and poverty within a particular country, and access to food at the household level in those kinds of contexts.
And just maybe to underscore something that I mentioned right at the beginning, just to make that point again, the issue of world hunger is not, at least overall, it's not a production issue. That is, it's not that we can't grow enough food, right?
Yeah, I think I have to be a little bit careful when we say that. There's enough food in the world to feed everyone. On the other hand, there are a lot of people who depend on food production or agricultural production for their livelihoods. Mm-hmm. And to the extent that changing the amount of food produced or the way food is produced could improve people's livelihoods, then there is a production problem. But certainly if you add up the calories and micronutrients in the world, there's enough.
There are so many different things we could talk about. Let me just go to, well, say production distribution, maybe some questions associated with that. For example, I suppose that there are some people that say, well, maybe the problem is that people in various places, they don't have access to the most current agricultural technologies, new varieties of seed, the opportunity to have access to fertilizer, pesticides, all those things that farmers in the developed world use and have access to that have been, you know, sort of aside from environmental impact, have been demonstrated to increase yield. How much difference does something like that make, and does that offer some explanation?
I think it's important to get, as I said, back to the root of a hunger problem, which mm-hmm. is about poverty. Mm-hmm. And if poverty is a result of your farm technology, then putting the right technology in the right hands can do something about poverty and can do something about hunger. But it's very rare that there's just a technical fix. If we look at places where very little fertilizer is used and people are very poor and there's a lot of hunger, part of the problem is that there's no fertilizer available. Part of the problem might be the markets don't exist to buy the fertilizer or distribute the fertilizer, or the finance might not be there to get it. Part of it might be an agricultural policy that limits the availability. Part of it might be an absence of a market for the output of what you could produce. So technology, agricultural technology in particular, might be part of the problem, but it's rarely the whole problem, and rarely can an isolated technological silver bullet fix the problem, although it's often an important piece of the puzzle.
What about something as basic as roads? That's another thing that you look at, and some people would wonder, well, how much of an issue if you don't have a good transportation infrastructure is going to make it difficult for the inputs, the kind of things that we've talked about, to get to the farmers who need them, and then for anything that's produced to get that to market, whether that be the next big town or something above that. I mean, if you can't move things around efficiently, how great a problem is that?
Right. Well, infrastructure is key in many ways. It's something that we in perhaps the United States take for granted, right? But if you actually look at the history of the development of Illinois, the development of railroads was key to the state's development and moving grain from farm to markets. So you're absolutely right. Not just roads, but also telecommunications. What are the prices being offered in markets that farmers can be aware of, or farm cooperatives can be aware of, that when they go to the market to sell their crop, they're well informed, right? So there's getting the inputs to the farmer, assuming the credit mechanisms are in place, and getting the crop to market and knowing what market prices are so farmers can negotiate a fair price. These are important conditions for agricultural development.
Hmm. Our guest in this part of Focus, Tom Bassett, he's the last person you heard. He's a professor of geography at U of I here in Urbana-Champaign. Alex Winter Nelson is professor of agricultural and consumer economics at the U of I. They're the co-authors of The Atlas of World Hunger. It's published by the University of Chicago Press. And that was what we're talking about. Some of what you will find in the book. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455. I jumped in here and talked about some specific things, and maybe it might be worth taking just a step back to talk about how it is that in the past people have approached this very question. It looks as if, as you explained, that they've looked at various different levels. They've tried to look at what was going on with hunger at the nation level, and they've looked at what's going on at the family level, and they've looked at what's going on at the individual level. All sorts of ways of looking at individuals' health and the quality of their diet and how much families have and how much countries have, all of that. Does that somehow come up short in answering the questions that you wanted to answer? And that is why it is you developed your own index?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I think at the beginning of the show you mentioned almost a billion people in the world not having enough to eat. Mm-hmm. And that's a number that's used a lot. It comes from a very sophisticated effort to measure the number of people in the world who consistently lack access to enough calories. It's a number that the FAO generates looking at the food availability that Tom mentioned before, combining that with some information on distribution over households, and then applying their estimate of some kind of a minimum requirement. One of the things that troubled us, or a number of things that troubled us about that measure, hunger is about more than calories, for example. Mm-hmm. The data are based on a 3-year average of availability, so it's really looking at chronic, consistent caloric deprivation. A couple years ago, when we had some sudden food price spikes in 2008, there was this dramatic increase in the number of people who were identified as hungry by that measure. One of the things that troubled me and Tom was that if that measure had been a good measure of hunger, it should have identified the people who would fall into deprivation if there was a sudden shift in the markets. So if we're going to measure our progress as a world in alleviating hunger, we ought to be measuring our progress in a way that's not sensitive to sudden shifts like the price of food 1 year. We shouldn't be misrepresenting our long-term pattern of alleviating this problem. And so the Hunger Vulnerability Index was trying to identify that broader population of people who are either currently hungry or likely to become hungry, so at risk that a small shock would make them hungry. We also wanted to capture people whose deprivation might be seasonal. That is, you might have enough food on average over 3 years, but if at the end of every month there isn't enough, or if each year before the harvest there isn't enough, we feel like you ought to be counted as among the hungry or among the at risk. Likewise, if you're not getting enough to be healthy because of a micronutrient deficiency, not enough vitamin A to have a healthy immune system, then you ought to be counted in the measure. So we developed this index to capture people who were suffering from more than just caloric deprivation, but were indeed food deprived, and people who were at risk of falling into this deprivation when something occurs like a sudden change in the price of food, or maybe a natural disaster. Mm.
Well, if you take the number of people who at this moment don't have enough food, and then you add on to that people who are food insecure, does that end up being a much bigger number than the conventional numbers we use, like that number that I used at the beginning?
Well, certainly you would expect that. Unfortunately, we generate an index that doesn't translate to a number of people. So one of the beauties of that prevalence of undernourishment measure that you used is that it gives you a number, and there's a great deal of value to that. I don't want to discredit that number, but when we say it, we have to recognize that that is really only a subset of the people who are suffering for lack of food or lack of food security. It's an important subset, but it's not the whole picture. So our index, like any index, can be used to measure trends, can be used to measure comparisons across countries, but it doesn't give us that kind of firm number of people.
We have a caller here. Why don't we go ahead and bring them into the conversation, someone who is in Elgin on our line four. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. I'm just curious. When you did these studies, was it just local? I mean, was it just the United States or was it all over the world? And I find it odd that we see all these commercials running on a daily basis, you know, feed the starving children in another country when we have the biggest problem, or one of the biggest problems, for a civilized nation like us. Did you take any of that stuff into account, and why? And I also do see on a daily basis a lot of waste. When we go out to eat to dinner, I see a lot of people, you know, they'll order a big plate and they'll eat half of it. To me, that's waste. And I myself have participated in giving some of my homegrown crops to other people in need. So I think that's what it's got to come down to. I think more of us, people like me, have to find these people, and like Lazarus House, Habitat for Humanities, and other organizations that donate food product that maybe you grow in your backyard. I'm just curious what you'll say on this. I'll get off and listen.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, good questions.
Great. Thank you for your question. The book scope is global. We're interested in, as the title suggests, world hunger. So the focus is largely on countries throughout the world that are experiencing hunger vulnerability. That said, I'm a geographer, and I'm interested in mapping phenomena at different scales. So the global scale, the national scale, that tells us something about processes and patterns. But you're right, you're absolutely right. It's what about individual countries? What about within the United States, at the state level, at the county level? We do actually have a section of the Atlas devoted to those subnational mapping of hunger. And we actually have a map of the United States at the county level showing the recipients of food stamps, for example, and the percentage of poor households, eligible households, that eligible for food stamps that are actually receiving them. So the you're absolutely right. The hunger is global. It's close to home, and it's across the seas. In the United States, hunger is up because of this high unemployment and this current economic recession. Since 2008, the number of people receiving food stamps has gone up to 41 million households. And but we know that there's still a large segment of the population that is eligible for food stamps that's not receiving them. So the kinds of programs, activities that you mentioned, such as food banks and soup kitchens and providing food to those nonprofit community organizations that do, in fact, help those people who are not on food stamps, or those households that are on food stamps that still need to supplement their food with these other sources. This is very important. So the Atlas does bring attention to the what we call the sort of uneven geography of plenty and abundance and scarcity in the world, that there are places where there's more than enough food to for everyone to consume, but we know that there's hunger in the midst of plenty, and we do look at the United States as one case in point.
Okay. Well, other questions are welcome. Comments, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. Just to go back to something that I think Alex Winter Nelson was talking about, are there a lot of places where if all you look at is the calories that people consume, just, you know, how much food do they have and how much food do they eat? But then you there are people who have enough food just from the calorie point of view, but then when you look at the quality of their diet, and how that affects their health, that there are actually people who have problems related to dietary insufficiency, that it's not just about the volume of food, but it's about what it actually what it is that they have to eat.
I can't point to a specific example where you have a shift from apparently enough to not enough, but you see some real changes in the comparisons and intensities of deprivation. So if you look only at caloric access at the household level, so looking at distribution of calories across households, then you see a problem in India, and you see a much, much more severe problem throughout East Africa. If you factor in issues like health outcomes that reflect things like access to vitamin A or access to a diverse diet, continuous access to food for women and children, then India actually looks much worse than most of Africa. So if we take child growth failure as an indicator of a poor quality diet or an indicator of poor distribution within a household, then actually health outcomes, nutritional outcomes are worse in India than in East Africa. If we look only at caloric availability, then India appears to have a problem, but it appears to be making a lot of progress towards addressing that problem, and it appears to have a much much smaller problem than sub-Saharan Africa.
You know, one of the things that you graphed out here has to do with obesity. And that's something that's been getting a lot more of attention, a lot more attention here in the United States, particularly for the issue of obesity in children and teens and the health effects that that has. I guess that I was not surprised if you take a look at the maps that show levels of obesity for adults. That what you see there is not particularly surprising. You see developed countries like the United States has high levels of obesity. The thing that I guess I found a little bit surprising was the map that showed the issue of child obesity. That there are some countries that apparently have high levels of child obesity that to me is very surprising. For example, in North Africa, there seems to be a very high level of obesity among children. And in some other countries, too, maybe not as high as that sort of level. But I was surprised by some of that and wondered how does one explain that?
Obesity is a global problem. excuse me. And, you know, the maps have a lot of blank spots on them because when we made the atlas, there wasn't as much data as it would be nice to have. Mm-hmm. But that problem of overweight and obesity in North Africa goes beyond children to adults as well. We tend to see it when countries have fairly rapid urbanization and income growth. And that combination of urbanization and income growth leads to a lot of changes in diet as well as in behavior. So when people move from country to city, they tend to become more sedentary at one level. But food, the costs of a healthy diet change quite dramatically. So in urban areas that tend to be lower income, it's very hard to get a healthy, diversified diet with lots of fruits and vegetables. So we tend to see people moving more towards processed foods, which are more convenient and cheaper. And of course, sugary beverages, which are more convenient and cheaper, especially when there's not a good water supply. And so we see this outcome. I know, Tom, you probably want to add to that.
No, I think that what's interesting is that the cost of obtaining these calories has declined. Nutritionists have pointed this out. But it's the quality of the calories that's at issue here. So the poor can, in fact, consume sufficient quantity of calories, but it's the quality of those calories that and again, talking about, you know, differences between or similarities between, say, the United States and the Global South, there's good studies showing that the access of the poor in the United States to high-quality food is not as high as it is for sort of middle-income and upper-income households. They don't find supermarkets with a variety of foods available to them in their neighborhoods as you find in middle-income, upper-income households. So that's it's a problem that also helps explain obesity in this country.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let's talk with someone in Atlanta, Illinois next. Line number four right here, toll-free line. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen. Great conversation and a dawning problem, no doubt about it. My question is a little bit more basic, and you might have covered it. I got in a little bit late, about 10 minutes late, so if you covered it, just shut me off. But my question is, with increasing populations and erosion of farmland, aren't we really heading up a creek with no paddle? I think everybody will agree, science says that deserts are increasing in size. And if you look at this winter, the tillage that was able to be done here in the fall, we've opened up this soil, our own soils here, to tremendous amounts of erosion, which over the last 100 years have been tremendous. And so the problem, you know, from my point of view of solving this with the population possible increases over the next century and the erosion of land, it looks to me like we're really going to have to make some dramatic changes in how we grow our food. What do you think?
Well, these are good questions, and these are ones that we've examined as well, because they do seem to be shared by many people, that there's some kind of strong relationship between, say, population growth rates and hunger. And frankly, our analysis doesn't show that to be the case. And what we do is, in fact, we kind of graph population growth rates by country with our index, our hunger vulnerability index, and do not see any strong correlation between the two, population growth rates and hunger.
What but about in the future?
The future is not that dark, I don't think. And if you look, in fact, population growth rates, fertility rates, especially in the developing world, they seem to be declining faster than anticipated. That is the average number of children born by a woman is declining widely throughout the developing world. So it seems that that population growth rates, which we've already seen declining certainly in Western Europe, is what we should expect in the future. So I think what, you know, the emphasis should be more on access to existing resources and the capacity to buy food or to produce food. So that means access to land to produce it or access to incomes to purchase food. I think that those are the key issues here.
I would hope you're right, and I think you're absolutely right. I think the African population growth has really, you know, went down, I mean, surprisingly. So there might be some truth to that, and I certainly hope so. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right.
If I could follow up on that one, I fully agree with Tom that perhaps we've exaggerated the significance of population growth, but I think we have to be careful not to underestimate the importance of demand growth. And over the last 10 years, there have been some serious changes in world food demand that do put pressure on the production system. Population growth is one factor, but I would say certainly the demand for fuel from food is a serious shock to the world food system, as well as the shift towards a more meat-based diet or animal product-based diet in developing countries that are seeing higher incomes. So as incomes grew in East Asia and South Asia, and people began consuming more animal products, more meat and more dairy, a lot of food that used to go to direct consumption was diverted to feed, and that meant less available for people to eat. Likewise, with the development of biofuels, we've seen an awful lot of corn and other food products diverted out of the food system. Those increases in demand for agricultural production have put a strain on the ability to meet demand. And so I think the caller raised some concern about our ability to sustainably produce enough food to meet demand. There are real technical challenges if we are going to sustainably produce enough food to meet demand for these, or I should say enough agricultural products to meet food and non-food demand for agricultural products. We do need to change the way we produce, because in many ways our production systems have been shown to be unsustainable in terms of their drawdown on water resources and other environmental impacts, and we have to find ways to produce more. That challenge is very real.
Right. In relationship to that point, Alex, on demand, that was reminds me of a conversation I had a couple of weeks ago with a general manager of a cooperative, a grain cooperative here in East Central Illinois. And he mentioned 20% of the corn being produced in this East Central Illinois area is going towards production of biofuels. So it's not only, I guess the point here, it's not just mouths to feed, but it's gas tanks to feed.
Our guests in this part of Focus are Tom Bassett and Alex Winter Nelson. Tom Bassett is professor of geography, University of Illinois, here in Urbana-Champaign. Alex Winter Nelson is professor of agricultural and consumer economics. And they are the co-authors of the Atlas of World Hunger. It's an attempt to come up with some better measurements of hunger around the world and better ways of getting at the causes of hunger. The book is published by the University of Chicago Press, if you'd like to take a look at it. Also, I do want to mention that there is a website, which is worldhungeratlas.com, right, which has some of the same maps that are in the book. So people would like to go to that and take a look at some of the things that we're talking about. They find the same material or some of the same material. No,
Updated maps. Oh, right. Okay. So, for example, the map showing the percentage of households receiving food stamps, eligible households that are receiving food stamps in the U.S. by county. The map in the Atlas dates from the early 1990s. There's now one from 2008, I believe, is the most recent data. So what the website does is tries to provide both updated maps that are in the Atlas as well as new maps that do not appear in the Atlas, as well as we have a site for resources for educators that would like to use the Atlas in teaching. We have a number of interesting sites there that could be useful.
All right, very good. So people can certainly look for the book, but they can go on the web and take a look at the website as well. Questions are welcome here. We're at about a little bit past our midpoint, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and the email is will-talk@illinois.edu. Here's another caller, someone in Lovington. This is line number two. Hello.
I had a question that the caller previous to me pretty well asked, really. But my question kind of changed when you said that talked about the fuel and livestock usage. How much do those reduce stocks and availability in the world to poor people? I thought the stocks in the world still weren't low for everybody that needed it.
If you look at global stocks, actually, we had for all the 20th century, increasing food availability per person globally, and generally increasing food stocks with an occasional blip. But starting in about the year 2000, that began to change. Food stocks globally started a downward trend, and that picked up after ethanol came online. So up until about 2009, from 2000 to about 2009, there was a declining trend in global food stocks that has reversed in the last couple of years as corn production has picked up. I don't know if that fully answers your question or not.
Well, I don't know. It doesn't seem to me like the stocks are low enough that anybody's probably starving because of that. You know, I hear that. I don't know. It sounds to me like it's just kind of a weak association. It seems to me like there's a lot of ways that food can't get to poor people, and I really doubt that the use of ethanol in the United States has a whole lot to do with somebody starving in Africa. I mean, I don't think the food was going there from us anyway, was it?
That's a very good issue that you raise, and an incredibly important one. The key thing I think to bear in mind is that the global food market is very integrated. So when the food price goes up when the price of corn goes up in Illinois or anywhere, the price of food is likely to be going up in Africa. And it might not be the corn that's grown in Illinois that ends up in East Africa, but the markets are integrated. So when we saw the prices for corn and soy go up in 2008, 2009, they saw food prices go up where people are hungry and more people fell into hunger. And that is partly because of demand for biofuels, not solely. There are a lot of factors that go into why prices have gone up, down, and back up again. Certainly production in other parts of the world is part of the story. Demand for feed is part of the story. But biofuels are also part of the story. Now, I'm sure you're aware food prices fell down from their peak, or corn prices fell down from their peak last year. In some parts of the world, the prices of food that people were eating also fell. In other parts of the world, it didn't, and that had to do with failures of market integration. And now, of course, prices are looking, from a producer's perspective, pretty strong, and the other side of that is that they're pretty high for consumers in poor parts of the world.
Oh, thank you.
All right, thank you. I want to get to, and I have another caller here or two, and we want to make sure we get to that. But something I want to touch on. We have talked about some of the things that have often been pointed to as explanations for hunger. For one thing, for example, that we did talk about was population growth. Also, people point to things like war and disease and natural disaster, where you find the correlations to be not very strong. Two things where there are strong correlations that I think are very interesting are literacy rates and gender equality. And what you have found is that as literacy rates rise and as gender equality in society increases, your hunger vulnerability index goes down. And in the case of you have the graphs in the book, and in the case of gender equality, the decline slope is really steep. That is, the hunger becomes less as gender equality increases, and the same thing happens with literacy. Is that at all surprising? Did you was that something that you expected to find?
Well, the way we proceeded in writing this book was to ask ourselves these questions. What do you think the relationship is between this? These are common assumptions, and so we sort of systematically reviewed the literature and then found what we thought would be good data to compare with our vulnerability index. So with respect to gender equality, we used the United Nations Development Program's indicator of gender inequality. It's called the Gender Development Index, which measures the differences between men and women in regard to literacy, life expectancy, and income. And points to what is the difference between men and women. And so the greater the difference, of course, the lower the status, the higher the inequalities. And right, so we saw a strong, very strong correlation between hunger vulnerability and gender inequalities. And we think that's probably what explains the high levels of hunger and hunger vulnerability in countries like India, where we know there's more than enough food to go around. In fact, India is a major exporter of grain. That said, we know that there's lots of hungry people, and we think that gender inequality explains a lot of that, because what that means is that women do not have the power within the households to negotiate access to land, for food, for income, or because they have low education levels, they cannot get jobs to acquire incomes. And one of the components of our vulnerability index is child growth failure. That is the percentage of children below the age of five who are below their normal height for their age. Mm-hmm. And so given the strong relationship between children and welfare and their food consumption and women's status within the household, we think that probably explains quite a bit of that relationship.
Well, are we talking about a thing that ultimately goes back to poverty or affluence? That is, access to education for everyone in society, girls particularly, connects to earning power, the potential for the family to earn. And then, as we said, there's this big – what hunger is about is about poverty. So your ability to – there may be food, but if you don't have money to buy it, you're going to be hungry.
You know, our conceptualization – that's right, David, absolutely. You got it. We also see a relationship between say, the literacy rates of a population, the education of a population, and the development of resources and technology, which, of course, feeds back into its capacity to produce food and create jobs that improve incomes, right? So that the educational dimension is key for multiple facets of the problem.
Yeah. I don't know if there's anything you want to add.
No need.
Well, let's take another caller. Champaign County, line 3. Hello.
Hi. Why did Russia stop wheat exports? Why not just charge more for the wheat? And comment on harvested grain reserves worldwide. Supposedly it's 100 days now. That's grain in storage already. And if bad weather, et cetera, reduces the harvest, what's out there now already growing that people can use as food? Like, would more fishing help in that case? Okay.
All right. Is that something you're talking about?
Oh, I can, briefly, I'm not aware of the details of current stocks and what commodities are in storage, but certainly if there's a sudden shock and there's less food available, we're likely to see prices go up and there being a lot of diversions. So food that might have gone to animal feed goes to human consumption as the prices go up, and food that might have gone into some industrial use is probably diverted into human consumption as the price goes up. But of course, as that happens, the vulnerable households can't afford the food. And so we get more hunger. I don't know that I could say anything more about that other than it is a real risk and a real concern, and certainly a concern for national policy. Countries have to make a decision whether they're going to have strategic grain reserves in case of these kinds of outcomes or rely on the markets. Strategic grain reserves are expensive and difficult to manage, and so it's not an easy question to answer or resolve.
Let me go to a little bit different subject. There are countries around the world where the economy depends very heavily on the production and export of just a couple of things. Couple of commodities. Cotton and coffee are two of the big ones, and you mentioned that in the book. What effect does that have on either levels of hunger, food insecurity, food availability in countries where a lot of the arable land is being taken up in producing something that is primarily going to be exported?
Well, this is a large topic, but let me just say for example, the fact that people in northern Cote d'Ivoire, where I do field research, grow a lot of cotton. That means what they are doing is participating in a global market, right? Because they're most of their cotton is exported on world markets. Therefore, they deal with cotton traders and importing countries, and they're affected by policies and different governments. For example, the United States, which has been giving billions of dollars in crop subsidies to cotton producers, which has encouraged them to keep on growing cotton. So we get lots of cotton in world markets and prices go down. So the incomes of farmers in northern Cote d'Ivoire go down. So their capacity to buy food is reduced. So my view is that farmers are growing crops because they think that there's an advantage to doing it, whether it's in East Central Illinois or northern Cote d'Ivoire. And when those markets work to their advantage, they'll participate in them because they can improve their standard of living. If markets turn against them, what are their options, I guess, is the question. And do they have the flexibility to move into other areas? And are there government programs and resources to facilitate those kinds of transitions? And that takes us into sort of the relationship between these countries and, say, larger sort of organizations, financial institutions like the World Bank, like the International Monetary Fund, which often has a very strong influence on these government policies because they have to borrow money from these institutions in many cases for their basic kind of programs. But that lending comes with conditions, and those conditions mean that often these governments cannot provide subsidies to farmers to make those transitions, as well as get access to health care or education. So the question was about growing cotton. But the point that we want to make here is that growing cotton, that these farmers who seem to be in the farthest corners of the world here are actually very much active in world markets, and their livelihoods are affected by these markets. Mm-hmm.
Well, then I suppose someone would ask what seemed to be a simple-minded question. They would say, well, does it really make sense to be putting so much energy into – I mean, if food insecurity is an issue, does it really make sense to put a lot of energy into growing something that you can't eat? Whether that be cotton, you know, or whether, you know, coffee's nice, but you know, that doesn't — coffee and cocoa are not going to take care of your basic nutritional needs.
Right. Our view is that that hunger is linked to poverty. Now, what produces poverty, right? Well, low prices for crops, right? So if farmers can grow coffee and cotton and have a high standard of living, they can, right? Now, in the absence of those favorable markets, what we hope for are safety nets, government programs to provide food to households that need it, right? And so like our food stamp program in this country, or programs in Mexico and Brazil that support households. So it's access to income. And if that income is from growing corn or growing cotton, as long as people in a country have access to food, I think that's the issue.
Yeah. We're coming to the point here where maybe we have about 5 minutes now, and we've touched on a lot of things here. I want to make sure at this point, at least where we have a couple of minutes left, if there's something in particular that you think is really important to hit on that we haven't yet, I want to make sure that we do it. Something that really comes to mind?
Well, you mentioned a while ago, David, that a common belief is that hunger is the result of some kind of natural calamity or violent conflict, price shock, and that's what the press often writes about. We see hardship, acute hardship, in these kind of moments, and in our analysis, these are — we call it exacerbating conditions or exacerbating events. That whether it's a tsunami or an earthquake, right? A food price shock, that typically these kinds of events adversely affect a certain group of households. And we saw that in this past year in the case of Chile in the earthquake, in the case of Haiti with the earthquake. In fact, the magnitude of the earthquake was much stronger in Chile, but much fewer households suffered the calamity. And because the standard of living, the poverty rates are much lower in places like Chile, right? So it's the poverty that is to us the most important underlying condition. Now, the sources of poverty, of course, are complex, and we discuss some of those dimensions in the Atlas. But I'd just like to emphasize, I guess, that those kinds of events or conditions that sort of push people over the edge, that's often what we see in the press. We're interested in why are people on the edge? How'd they get there? And how can those conditions be changed so that there's less vulnerability?
All right, let's talk with we have time for at least one more caller, someone here in Spring Bay. This is line 4. Hello.
Good morning. I'd like to introduce peak oil into the discussion. In the United States, we put 10 calories of fossil fuels into every calorie of food that we get back. If you look at the population at the turn of the century, 20th century, it was a little over a billion. Today, it's over 7 billion, 100 years later. If you look at the use of fossil fuels at the beginning of the 20th century, it was probably under 10 million barrels a day. Today, it's 80 million barrels a day. David, I think you are absolutely right when you're talking about exports and all of that, food security, but you know, with the population increase, the increase in fossil fuels, and the increase in food, certainly food production, the one thing that I identify is the increase in fossil fuels, and those are in the process of peaking. So the argument would be that we're overshooting our carrying capacity in the solar carrying capacity of the Earth, and I'll get off and listen. Thank you.
All right. Well, this is the sustainability question. You want to?
I'm really glad that came up. Thank you for posing the question. Without getting into a discussion of peak oil, I think we can say that our current production systems globally aren't sustainable. Not to say that a particular farmer in Illinois isn't managing the natural resources well, but globally the resources going into agricultural production aren't being used in a sustainable way. And you can certainly point to treatment of soils globally and water resources. And so while there is enough food in the world to feed every mouth and to feed them a nutritious diet, there is a real pressure to develop new sustainable technologies, to make sure that farmers around the world have access to those technologies, to make sure that their produce is distributed in a way that gives consumers access to it and makes it profitable. And we shouldn't underestimate the significance of agricultural research to develop those new sustainable technologies, because business as usual really can't continue.
Well, in about 30 seconds or a minute, if you look at what we have done in the past to try to attack the issue of world hunger, and by looking at it in maybe in the kind of way that you have, does that suggest that the approach that we've taken has been the right one, or that we actually need to think differently about it?
Well, we're hoping that our emphasis on poverty, on access to income and resources, and our attention to trying to identify, locate the hunger problem, provides more information about its dynamics and its distribution. And in terms of the question of sustainability, I would just add to Alex's comment that, you know, this, we're talking about consumption levels, and these are hardly unequal across the world, right? So if you look at, say, the energy footprint of an average American and compare the energy footprint to the average Kenyan, it's a ratio of 16 to 1. So, you know, is the problem Kenyan population growth, or is it a question of consumption levels? And can we continue into the future to sustain these levels of consumption as population, as incomes increase, for example, in places like China? Is it possible for Chinese to live the same way as Americans? Or do we have to sort of rethink, our consumption All levels?
Right. We will have to leave it at that, with the suggestion that if you'd like to learn more, you can look at the Atlas of World Hunger by our guests Tom Bassett and Alex Winter Nelson, published by the University of Chicago Press. Or you can go to the website, which is worldhungeratlas.com, and you can see some maybe a little bit more current information than it was contained in the book. Tom Bassett is professor of geography here at U of I. Alex Winter Nelson, he's professor of agricultural and consumer economics. Thank you very much.
Thank you, David, for having us.
Thanks a lot.